Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions in the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. On this show, I interview lawyers ditching the billable hour and experts who can help attorneys move beyond billing time. Thanks to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later, and use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. You get 10% off, and it supports the show. The best way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. I am thrilled to have with me today another warrior against the billable hour, Sean Jardine. Welcome to the podcast, Law Subscribed.
Oh, Matthew, thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm delighted to be here.
So I've been playing catch up on all of your stuff and you know, you're obviously, you know, people just heard you say hello. You know, you're across the pond, as they say. So just in case other, you know, mostly American lawyers listening in right now, you know, they haven't come across your stuff yet. Give my listeners a quick intro to who you are.
Okay. I'm a lawyer. I qualified in 1986 and I qualified as a solicitor. And I realized that solicitor out of the US can mean slightly something other than being a lawyer. But I'm a solicitor. I set my own business up. That merged with another business, and it became one of the top 250 law firms in the UK by size, 247 people at its largest. I was elected CEO for a three-year term that lasted 4 years, 9 months, 11 days, not that I was counting or anything like that. And during my period as CEO, I managed to get out to America in 2017 and went to a conference on value-based pricing that was put together by Ron Baker and various other Verisage fellows. And I fell in love with value-based pricing and became slightly evangelical about wanting to ditch the billable hour. And so I'm at that conference, I met lawyers from all over the world, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America, but I was the only Brit there. And so I met all these wonderful people who had ditched the billable hour, kept in touch with them for a number of years, asked them huge amounts of questions. And then in 2020, 2021, I rolled out value-based pricing in my firm as a project, and it was a success. And then I thought, that's great. And then I turned 60, retired from private practice, and thought, well, I'll set up my own little business doing value-based pricing consultancy.
Spreading the good word, Sean.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the big yellow penguin was born.
So take me back. I think I missed the year. What was the, when did you go see Ron's talk? When was that?
2017.
Okay. 2017. So, and it basically ever since then, you knew that billing time just wasn't the way anymore.
Well, absolutely. You once you meet people out there, and I met people, some fantastic lawyers from the States, who were doing amazing things. And you just thought, I want some of that. This is the way that you can run a business. This is the way that your lawyers can practice law. It's better for the clients. The clients like choice. And so I just thought, well, how do you do that? I read everything that Ron wrote. I read everything that his Verisage fellows wrote. I listened to tons of podcasts. And eventually I kind of dreamt up this methodology based on John Kotler from the Harvard Business School Change Management Program. I thought, well, let's write it all down and then see whether we can get other lawyers to buy into this. Because I think, lots of lawyers hate it, but they just don't know what to do.
Right.
So we can start them on the path of righteousness.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes without saying, but you never know, just in case, when you were working as a solicitor and then you were at these firms, you were billing your time. Is that how you did it?
I was, yeah. I was a litigator. I was good. I was good at filling in timesheets. I was, very good at it. And that was fine. And I had a big team and I told them this is how we're going to do it. But actually, why do you want this artificial cap on our income, which is our hourly rate times the number of hours that we have available to bill, when you can remove that and you can charge more, and do less work? Because if I give up, one of my you know, war stories that I talk about was a client that probably 3 years ago, the dollar equivalent was probably $2,400 an hour I charged him, if I had charged him an hourly rate. But I billed him £600 to do something in 28 minutes.
Right.
And he was happy.
Right.
But, and I gave him a fixed price, and he spoke to me at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, wanted it done by 5 o'clock. And I said, yes, Andy, I can do that for you. It's going to cost you £600. And we delivered it within the 28 minutes. He was over the moon.
Right.
He's still in touch with me. But had I told him that was my hourly rate was £1,800 an hour, he wouldn't have paid it. He would have freaked. But for him, £600 was great value.
Right. It's one of these things where the only way you can make more money when you're billing time is you hire more lawyers, you know, or you hire more billers and you bill more time, or you raise your rates. But eventually your rates are going to get so high that even if you got something done in 28 minutes, they're not going to want to pay that, right?
Yeah.
That high rate. And, you know, what is it? And I think I want to touch on something else you said, which is you can make more money and work less. And what I think some lawyers hear with that, because they are so in this mindset of working more means there's more value. It's not that there's more value when you work more. It's that you could bill your client more when you work more. Working less and delivering more value is not a contradictory statement, right? So tell us a little bit. And then this is like the where you get into the value of what you're doing and pricing it. So like explain that concept in a little more detail, if you will.
Okay. Well, look, the value is complicated. You and I will value different things. We will automatically, or lawyers tend to automatically assume the client always wants cheapest. No, they don't. We don't buy the cheapest wine every time we go out for dinner. We don't all drive the same car. We don't all shop in the same, the cheapest shops for clothing. And once you understand that value is different and that people want choice, and I start giving you a choice as a client of, you know, three price points, you're still going to get a competent service. You're going to get the service delivered. How it gets delivered could be very different. So that if I want to deliver you a gold service, look, let's assume I've got a client who works for Goldman Sachs or a large bank. Are they really going to come out to my office to sign the contract for the property they want to buy? Or are they going to say, Sean, jump on a train. You bring the contract to me. I'll sign it because I will pay for you to do that. But we can craft certain offerings that are different for different clients because we wrongly assume that every client is the same and every client wants the same things and we should treat every client the same. And my whole ethos, my whole thinking is all clients are different. Let's offer them different packages. Let's offer them different prices depending on how busy we are at the lawyer at that time. And what they're going to be like to deal with. Are they going to be fun to deal with? Because if they're not going to be, they're going to be a very, very difficult, demanding client. I'm going to factor that into the price I give. And, you know, some lawyers think, oh, you can't do that. Do you know what? Yes, you can. Because if I give a high price and they don't, and they pay it, great. But if I were to give a low price and get a difficult client, I'd probably kick myself thinking I didn't want this work at this price. I would do it if it's three or four times the amount, but we've also then within our framework got to permit our lawyers to turn work away and accept that not every client is a good client. There are some clients that are the wrong fit for our firms. And if we can get our heads around that as a concept, as a structure, and empower our people to allow them to say, do you know what, Sean? This client is not nice to deal with. They do not respect what I'm doing. They are demanding. They don't pay their bills. I would like to not act for them again. We'll finish off this one job. But I don't want to act for them again. As soon as you start sacking clients, your lawyers will be very pleased because they know who our bad clients are. They know that. And we've just got to, as the management, as the owners, empower them to stop doing that work that they hate.
Right. And I'm so glad that you're on here because we've had some folks on that we've even had Ron Baker on the show, but we've never done a deep dive on value-based pricing in particular. I mean, we've more than scratched the surface of it. We had Mark Stiving of Impact Pricing on, and he talks about how, you know, value and how you value your services you offer and how you set your prices is his thing, but he doesn't come at it maybe from this more like value-based pricing approach that you're talking about. And another thing, just to give you context too, is you know, the way I do my practice and something that I promote typically is there's this latent legal market, which is people who could afford to pay something, but they need pricing certainty, right? And they can't afford to pay for time that they don't know how long something's going to take. But there are institutional clients who are used to paying billable hours and they have deeper pockets. And it's completely accepted. And I don't talk about it a lot on the podcast, but I think it's important to have that conversation because that, you know, I think it's a little bit more of a red ocean, if I'm being fair, because these are people who have been paying or business who have been paying billable hours. But you can disrupt that red ocean market with this type of model. And so giving a high number shouldn't be something like a high singular number, shouldn't be something that attorneys are afraid to do. And so I haven't been able to get through all your materials yet. Like I know I'm sure you could share more on why that is and what pricing certainty does for clients and why it's okay. And like, how do you even, because then at the end of the day, how do you decide what that big number is that you're giving them that's a singular value-based price? And then it's not about how long it takes to get to that result. You know, how do you come to that number and why is it okay that clients will they're willing to pay something like that? Because I think that's fair too. You know, that lawyers have.
Okay, let me give you a real life example. So I worked with this law firm, the employment lawyer, who had to give drafting new employment contracts for a corporate client. Now, one of the rules of value-based pricing that you will have heard Ron Baker talk about, I'm sure, and I repeat it in my book, is you get two pairs of eyes on every price. Nobody prices their work in isolation. Now, with this particular lawyer, he has a commercial client, needs new contracts of employment. We gave three options. The first one, we will send you some templates and some precedents. You fill them in with the guidance notes. You send them back. We'll check your homework. That's £2,000. Or we will do it for you in 3 weeks' time, £5,000. Or we will drop everything. We'll do it for you tomorrow. It's £8,000. Now, the client chose the £8,000 option. They knew they could get it cheaper. We'd given them two cheaper prices. Mm-hmm. But for them, commercially, they wanted it tomorrow. They were pleased to pay the £8,000 because for them, strategically, it was important to get it quicker. And so was the lawyer happy? Absolutely. He's going to do half his budget, monthly budget, in one day, the following day. Is the client happy? Yes, I've got the work at the time that I delivered it or when they wanted it the next day. And are the law firm owners, are the equity partners happy? Well, I hope so, because, you know, the margin for them on that work was very good. And the thing is, what we mustn't do is ever assume we know what our clients want. We've got to have conversations with them to find out what they want, because quite often, lawyers are sometimes very guilty of waiting for watch their clients speak, not really listening to what is being told, because they're waiting for the clients to stop speaking so I can tell you what you need. And actually, really what I've got to do is find out what you need, because when it comes to time, the only time that clients are interested in is turnaround time.
Right.
You know, that's all I care about. You know, if we're going to a surgeon, I don't want a surgeon to take longer on an operation on me than is necessary. I would pay more to have less time on the table. And right. It's the same with dentistry and everything else. We will pay shorter, you know, have shorter time. And I will ask every lawyer all the time, saying, if you are having some building works done at your home, you're having an extension built in your house, are you going to recruit a builder and all the subcontractors on a day work basis? And the answer is always, hell no. No, we're not going to do that. Yet we do that as professionals every single day. And we say we're experts. But what we can't do as experts is work out what the fee's going to be and give you a price. Well, that's not really an expert then, is it?
Oh, man. And I mean, the reason why we could do it, right? And I think this is more true. I think it's been a little re-regulated in the UK, if I'm not mistaken. But in the US, anyway, we have a monopoly, a complete monopoly on legal services, right?
Yep.
And so there's zero competition. So why should we ever do it any other way if that's the way that we can do it, right? So, I mean, with in the UK, I think like the regulations around delivery of legal services is different. And so what's it like there where there is more competition?
Absolutely. Well, the legal services were deregulated. Non-lawyers can own law firms now. So that wasn't the case when I started my career. And we've had all these new entrants coming into the market to deliver legal services. And only certain legal services have to be delivered by lawyers, like litigation or something like that. But non-contentious work can be delivered by, we have accountants doing probate work over here. So it is deregulated. But the thing is, the billable hour imposes a ceiling on what you can earn. And so everybody sticks to the billable hour because that's what we did. That's what we did. That's what we did. But actually, if I can earn, you know, £600 for doing 28 minutes work, why wouldn't I want to do that? If I can do, as a litigator, charge someone £2,000 to send a letter before action on a boundary dispute, why wouldn't I do that if I can? If I've got the clients, the quality of clients who are prepared to get that letter out on the day that they come in and see you, because it's urgent, because I've fallen out with my neighbor, because I want it done today, and I can say, yeah, I can offer you that service, I want to pay for the people who can pay for that. And, you know, and actually allow my lawyers to do that work where they will have clients that they value, their opinion is valued, they don't have to work and pull all-nighters and do all this ridiculous stuff that goes on in the profession, which I've never quite understood. And they will have happier working and more productive lives, and so will their colleagues, and they can work as teams. And that's really important. We want our lawyers to delegate the work to the right member of the team, not hold it up, not have partners doing billable hour work just to fill a timesheet.
Right, right. I was talking with this legal tech company. They're getting in on the generative AI space. And I was talking to a sales rep who's there. And, you know, a lot of times these legal tech companies, they're going to hire lawyers as sales reps because they could talk the jargon with the attorneys. And this attorney, you know, who's doing sales for this new legal tech company, could not grasp my business model, which is subscription, which is a form of recurring value-based pricing, yeah, essentially, right? So he just couldn't grasp it. And what finally convinced him of like the value of it was it never occurred to me to say it this way before. It's the inverse of the billable hour, right? Because the less time I spend on something, the more money I make, because I'm able to give that value, give that goal to the client, whatever it is, whatever thing I'm ultimately giving them. And with the subscription model anyway, one of those pieces of value is, and I think this is probably true with just value-based flat fee pricing in general, is price certainty.
Absolutely.
Which has value, right? So that has value, but also it's when that next legal thing happens or some employment issue happens or you get a contract handed to you, you don't have to worry about that. You're just going to give that to your lawyer to worry about it, right? And I said, it's the inverse. It's the less time I spend, the more money I make because of exactly what you're saying, right? My cap is not on how many hours, how long will this thing take for me to give it to them. So when you said timing matters to the clients, usually it's they want things done in less time. When you're not billing time, that's incentives aligned.
Absolutely. And the thing is, clients don't want to engage with lawyers at all. They don't want legal problems. And whereas at the moment the business model is, well, let's wait till the client topples off the edge of the cliff. We're in the ambulances at the bottom. We'll pick them up. We're sorted out at the bottom of the cliff, the problem. What if we were fence builders at the top of that cliff, preventing them from sleepwalking and falling over and reviewing their contracts and saying, well, actually, I can see you might have a problem here with what you've got. Let's fix this now so you don't have litigation down the road. They're going to think, brilliant. Thank you, Matthew. You've saved us from what might be a disaster. That's what they want. They want that certainty. That's why why do we pay insurance? We don't pay insurance because we want to be paid out. We don't want the fire. We pay so that we're protected. And this is the whole point. Let's try and protect our clients. Let's engage with them. Find out what they want, what they're trying to achieve. What's their exit strategy? What their hopes and aspirations for their families? The billable hour never allows us to do that, because if we're sitting there talking to the client and we're on the clock, they don't want to have small talk with us. And if we're a lawyer thinking, well, this work is non-chargeable, I don't want to have small talk with them anymore because I can't bill it. Whereas if actually I'm putting together a proposal for you, I'm going to create three price options. You choose which one it is. And then you choose. You don't care how many lawyers I put on this.
Right.
Don't care, because you've got a price. And I've working with law firms who say to their clients, you will never get a bill from us that you have not previously authorized. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah. There are some of these institutional clients, though, that they have a lot of investment in training and resources and departments and technology all around reducing billable hours from law firms. So they have a hard time letting go of that. Insurance companies come to mind, speaking about insurance, right? Mm. And so it's hard to convince them, the sunk cost fallacy, right? Well, we've invested in all this training and people and resources and technology. So why would, so how do you convince those types of clients? Like, how are you helping these law firms show these clients, like, this is better for you? You ignore the sunk cost fallacy. Like, let me show you. Like, don't give away all the secret sauce, but like, what are we to do as lawyers serving institutional clients who at least... There are some people in those companies that say we like the billable hour because we know how to reduce it.
Well, usually it's in-house counsel have usually started off life working the billable hour. So right. It's known to them. So they know how it works. They know how people pad timesheets. They know, et cetera, that, all time recorded might not actually be attributable to their matters. So that when they're actually paying out, we have an industry and technology to check what is there being billed for. So we have this complexity tax almost of we're not quite sure we trust our lawyers. So now we're going to have an industry within our organizations to check our lawyers because we don't trust them. But actually, what they want is their legal work done competently at a standard that they want. And we can offer them prices. And again, you might have one client, you might have a corporate client say, for this bit of work, yeah, good enough is good enough. Or it might be, well, this bit of work is so important, it's bet the farm, I want everybody on it and everything checked. But attitudes to risk will vary. But if we know, and I think it was Levi Strauss did this probably maybe 15 years ago, they put all their legal work with one firm for a global fee. So next year, so the onus is then on that firm. Let's put our best people on their problems so that we solve them quickly, and let's do the preventative work because right. We don't want the problems to arise.
Right.
Then if a client then says, we want you to spend 5% less next year, that might be really no problem to you if you've solved all those problems and you're just going to go through the run-of-the-mill stuff that happens to crop up as by virtue of running a business, dealing with employees or whatever. And we've just got to get to know our clients a whole lot better. And again, as I come back to presenting options, taking the example of the employment contracts, if that company wanted to reduce their spend on employment contracts, they would have gone for the £2,000 one. They would have gone for the £2,000. They would have got it. That's the cheapest. For them, on the day, it was the £8,000 was because strategically it was important for them to do it. We don't know all about our client's strategy. We don't know everything about them. Sorry to break it to lawyers that might be listening. We are not always the trusted advisor. We'd like to think we are, but we're not. And quite often we're not. Because we haven't earned the right to be trusted, because we haven't spent that time getting to really know and understand our clients. And when you consider the role that we have, when a new client comes into our office, we can ask them anything. At that time, we can ask them anything. But usually all we ask them about is the transaction that's in front of us. Not, you know, if it's a new corporate client, we might not say, have you got a shareholders agreement? We might not say, have you got powers of attorney in relation to the business operation? We might not talk to them about their data protection policy or their intellectual property. But if we were to have a great conversation with them about their whole business, we would find out a lot more. We would find out extra work we can do. And the client is going to think, wow, this is someone who's really interested in what I do, interested in my baby, my business, because it's, you know, they're proud of their business. It might be pug ugly to us, but, you know, we've just got to show that we care.
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
And you know, going back to the in-house example, and I think in-house attorneys, maybe if they have less experience, less of the dogma, they worry less about the dogma around the billable hour, you know, they do this already. Although there's, not necessarily, because you hear from like the salespeople how like, you know, the law department at a company is slowing down the sales process, which definitely does happen. But if you're just being paid for problem avoidance with a contract that's presented, even just like something like an NDA, if you're making money, the longer you look at that document and the more times it goes back and forth, you're going to find ways to make that document perfect. But when the value is get it done quick so the sales process can proceed and you just want to avoid big potential future expensive problems, there's value to your client to even say, I've reviewed this document. It's not perfect, but it's okay. You know, and put the ball back in their court as to, now we can't go back and forth a lot of times, or you know that at least, you know, we've avoided these things are not in there, which is a good thing. We don't need to change the indemnification clause. It could be a little better worded. It would be nice if it was a little more mutual, you know, but there's value. I think there's value to the contract is good. We don't need to change anything. Go ahead and sign. And how many billable hour lawyers look at a contract and say, I've evaluated the risk. It's okay to sign it.
Very, very few. And one of the problems is that if you take a contract, I worked with a lawyer a month or so ago, and she was drafting software as a service contracts. That was her thing. She left a magic circle firm set up on her own. She drafts SaaS contracts. And we worked together and said, look, we want to create a gold service option for this. And she said, well, I just draft contracts. I said, no, I'm a great fan in something called possibility thinking, where we turn the problem at the word, how can we possibly do something, turn it into a question. And I said, what can we possibly add to this contract, to your service, that will add value for the client? And I time it on my phone. We've got 3 minutes starting now. Just write. What could we possibly write? Possibly add. We came up with about 15 options that we could add to that. And that would include, we could possibly say to the client, here is the contract. And we will review this every year for you to make sure it's compliant within the jurisdiction. And also, if the law changes suddenly, we will tell you and give you the updated one. And we will come to your office and sit down with all your salespeople, explain what this contract is, how it works, and why they shouldn't delete clauses that they tend to delete, because we want the salespeople to understand it. And we could offer an eyes-on service where if you're signing up a new client and it's a significant value, we will check that contract for you just to give you the peace of mind that it's going to be right. And if you have got a very big contract, we'll come to you with the negotiations and sit by your side. And this particular lawyer, at the end of this exercise, she said, Sean, I needed you yesterday. I said, what do you mean you needed me yesterday? She said, if I had had all this yesterday, this contract that I sold to a client for £2,000, I think he would have paid £15,000 for all of this. And do you know what? With those features, you might not even use them. The law might not change. You might not have to update them. He might never call you to come in and sit by his side for a client negotiation. But they would buy that level of certainty that gives them the thing, well, I can if I need to. And for them, that was valuable to the client.
Right, right. You know, hearing that type of value that you could provide along with that service, and the fact that it's also like a SaaS contract makes me think, gosh, I mean, there's value in subscribing to that kind of a service, right? And so, like, this is where I feel like the subscription model could come into play really well and work well with value-based pricing. And now, don't get me wrong, if you could get a client to pay you $15,000 to put together this contract for you and have those things, and they're not on subscription, I mean, more power to you. That sounds like an incredible, I mean, if it's good value for the client and you can make that kind of money with a one-time payment, go for it. But I do think that, like, some of those things, like the annual check-in on compliance, I mean, you've got yourself an annual subscription right there. So maybe you could still sell it for, you know, 2,000 or 5,000 pounds or what have you. But now you get them signed on for a 500 a month, you know, additional fee. And we'll check that for you every month to make sure it's compliant. Right. And so that's like another thing that you can do, looping in the subscription model. I can't help myself, Sean. I'm the subscription attorney. What do you think about something like that?
Yeah, but if you look at the way that software, when we buy as lawyers, when we buy software, the pricing models that software companies give to us are tiered with options and user numbers, etc. Let's just think differently about how we can offer services to our client in the same kind of way. Because once you get into the rhythm of doing it, and once we get people permitted to start brainstorming and coming up with things, we will come up with some great, great solutions that clients want to buy. Because come back to the beginning, we all like choice in our lives, and that's important to us.
Yeah, I mean, choice is incredibly powerful. And when, I have not, for flat fee attorneys that they're just focusing on flat fees, and they're not maybe in the mindset of value-based pricing, I have not seen them do what you're saying when it comes to options. I usually do see more options with attorneys using the subscription model. So I have two questions for you. One is, are you working with any lawyers who are using value-based pricing with subscription models, or is it more flat fee? And then also, like, how do you figure out how to do the options thing? Because I still think that that's going to be really hard for lawyers to do.
Okay. At the moment, I'm not working with attorneys on subscription models. It's more value-based. Mm-hmm. It is creating these three options. And how do we create these? Well, we've got to accept value-based pricing is an art, not a science, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's no formula for this. We have to some extent, we have to, once we empower our lawyers within a framework to charge what they think is appropriate and charge more than they ordinarily would have. Let me give you an example. A probate lawyer came to me. I was the second pairs of eyes on the price. And this Excel spreadsheet calculator says it's £6,000. This job is £6,000. And I said to her, okay, how busy are you? She said, Sean, I'm absolutely maxed. Can't take on any more work. I said, well, what? Okay, so that's pushing the price up. I said, why can't you delegate this? Sean, I can't delegate it. I said, why can't you delegate it? You've got a big team. said, Sean, I can't delegate this piece of work because it's a probate. The mother has died. I've just left the three siblings in my office. They're all arguing over the jewelry, who gets mum's engagement ring, who gets the watch. And she said, the mother hasn't even been buried yet. And this probate, I'm going to have three conversations on every item across three siblings who do not like each other. I said, okay. I said, are you going to enjoy this piece of work? She said, I'm not going to enjoy this piece of work. It's going to be hard. I said, okay. I said, what do you want to charge? And she took a deep breath and she said, £24,000. Original price was six. She said, I want to charge 24. I said, price approved. She went back to the client and said, £24,000. They came back to her the following day and said, yep, that's agreed. How does that lawyer feel now doing the work? She's thinking, I'm getting paid for all this. I can do this. Now, in that case, we only gave the client one price, a high ticket price, because she didn't want to do it at six, and it wasn't worth doing at six because of all the ancillary problems. Now, if we think about basic maths, if I give you a fixed price and it's, or leave it, it's a 50-50. Fixed price, or you're going to leave it. If I give you gold, silver, bronze, or leave it, it's 75-25% chance you might leave it. I got a 3-in-1 chance of you wanting to buy something from me. So it actually makes sense mathematically for us to create options. And, right. So, you know, lots of psychology around pricing and people tend to go for middle, but not always. I have clients quite often go for my premium offering. And I think, are they going to go for this? I don't know. And they do. And this is because we don't really know what our clients want until we really, really try and understand them.
Right. I mean, making it client-centric, I think, is a huge part of it, right? Because you're not just coming up with three different pricing options to see how much work are you going to do versus how much money you're going to make. You're talking about it with the client's interest in mind. This gives them the choice, puts the power back in their hands, like you said, and also you're coming up with three models, not just of the amount of work you want to do, but you're not quite sure what the need is that the client actually wants. And so when designing the options, yeah, that's what you're thinking about. I think making it client-centric first of all, it's great for the client, but it's also good business, right? Like you're probably gonna get more clients that pick one of those three than pick the fourth option of nothing.
Absolutely. And you've got, once you start getting into this and creating these templates and these options, clients will tell their friends, the way my lawyer works with me is this. And then other people being, well, I don't get offered that where I am. I just get told I've got a billable hour rate. And so all of a sudden, we've got our clients becoming our ambassadors for our brand and generating work for us because they're telling their friends about this and making recommendations. Right. And ultimately, the time for us to find out that the client is not the right fit is before we've done the work. Not do the work and then find out it's a client we shouldn't have taken on when they're not paying our bill. And again, lots of lawyers make that mistake where we're too busy to start, we're too keen to start work, and we don't take time to scope it, make sure the client's the right fit.
Yeah. You know, something I've tuned into a little bit, and I'm curious to know, I mean, you know, let me know if you think this is asking too much about the types of lawyers that you're working with, but I've heard you say she and her a lot, and I'll tell you that in the U.S., the attorneys who are ditching the billable hour and are doing innovative things in the practice, I've had far more women attorneys that are doing that on my podcast than I've had male attorneys that are doing it. So, I mean, at least in my experience, women are more likely to ditch the billable hour than men. Has that been what your experience has shown you too?
That's a really, really interesting insight, because if I think back to the two largest projects of which I've been involved with, which were over 3 months for each firm, two firms over 3 months, both led by women. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned the SAS contract matter that was a woman. Now, whether or not this is because women are smarter than men and thinking, actually, I want to work smarter, not harder, my wife will probably say, of course, Sean, that you've known that since the day you've married me. but also, the thing is, if the measure in law firms for promotion is always how many hours can you bill? The billable hour is guilty of sex discrimination.
Yeah.
You know, because males generally can bill more than females because we're not the care providers day to day. The females generally are. I know that's a, you know, bit of a wide-ranging statement, but
whether it's fair,
rule.
Whether it's fair that they are or not, I think is, you know, is one of these things where even if we can agree that they shouldn't be, you know, society puts pressure on them to do that, right?
Yeah,
I
yeah.
mean, that's,
yeah.
That's the culture that we're in does put that pressure on women, whether that's fair or not. And so, yeah. Yes, I've never actually had somebody say that it's sexist before, but I think that's been what, because I do ask this question of many of my guests. I'm like, you know, it's women, it's attorneys of color who are innovating. But ultimately, that is what it comes down to. It's like it more favors men over women, billable hour. And that's why, at least in the U.S., I haven't looked at data on the profession in the U.K., but, you know, we have more women going to law school than men in the U.S., and it's been that way for some time, but we still don't have majority leadership of women at these big law firms. And I think a billable hour is a huge culprit in that, which is part of the mission of the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same here. We have more women on the role, the solicitor's role, than men. And year on year, probably throughout the last 6-7 years, it is more women every year joining than men.
Right, right. So, I mean, now that you're cued into that, I mean, also, Sean, for potential, you know, consulting clients, you know, you probably get more interest from women attorneys who are in charge at law firms than you will for men, probably, I would think.
Well, I'm going to have to start mapping this now, aren't I now? You've given me something else to think of when I'm actually onboarding clients. It's not something I've automatically thought of, you know, but now I'm going to start doing it because, yeah, it's a really, really interesting point.
Yeah, yeah. So, because we are sort of getting close to, we're sort of trying to wrap up the interview here since we're at the second half of the interview now. But something else I'm curious about, because again, I'm not familiar with the legal ethics on collections and stuff in the UK. In the US, certain jurisdictions, mine being one of them, Illinois, now allows you, if you charge a fixed fee to your client, you can take that up front before the work is done and it goes right into your operating account. It doesn't need to go into a client trust fund account. Now, you can't have non-refundable fees that aren't earned. If you've earned a fee, that's a different story. And how you define that is still, we're still figuring that out in this new paradigm. I mean, this is only 6-7 months old of a new rule. So that fixed fee gets put right into our operating account. The client pays up front is allowed. You don't have to charge your client that way, but you can. It's now permissible. For these high ticket price fixed fees that you're helping lawyers charge their clients for valuable work that the client has chosen, are they paying that up front? Are they paying it in payment plans? Are they paying it at the end? Like, how does the payment feature work?
It varies. And it varies on a case by case. Like if a client is saying, well, look, I want to pay over a period of time, you're going to do your own risk analysis. And you might say, well, I don't mind you doing that, but I'm going to charge you more. If a client wants a cheaper price and you can say, well, if you can pay me all up front, I can do it cheaper, de-risk it for me, the lawyer. That's a conversation to be had. And it's just one of these variables. Payment terms is a variable. Access to talent. Do I want the practice area team leader partner dealing with this? Or am I happy to have a newly qualified lawyer dealing with this? And if the answer is, well, look, I'm happy with newly qualified dealing with this, happy days. That can be one of the variables. Access to talent will impact the price differently. And those are all things that you can play with when it actually comes to, you know, could it be, I will only communicate with you via the portal on our firm's case management system. I will do that for our cheapest offering. But if you are a gold client and you want that gold level of service, if you want me to come around your house or you want my mobile phone number, I will do that if you pay me the right price.
Right.
And what I often talk when I'm talking to lawyers over here is you probably have heard of David Beckham, a soccer star, who's
yes.
A global icon. Okay. He doesn't live too far from me here in Oxfordshire. And I would say, well, look, if David Beckham said, he wanted to retain you as a lawyer. Are you going to make him come into your office, or are you going to go to him? Oh, I'll go to him. Oh, look at the Beckham service that we're going to start now offering, because that could become our gold service. So then we strip features out to make our silver. We strip features out of silver to make our bronze. That's how we can tier our service levels.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, when you also say tiered service levels, I mean, it really makes me say, Sean, you got to start looking at the subscription model, because it lends itself so well to what you're doing and what you're talking about. And we didn't, Ron and I, when Ron was on the show, we didn't even spend too much time on value-based pricing, because we were all in on subscription. That was what we focused our conversation in on. And everything you're saying meshes. First of all, it's really important whether you're billing on subscription or flat fee. But in particular, I mean, this is valuable stuff for subscription law firms as well. So I think, which is why I'm happy to have you on the show, but I think you got to start thinking about that. So definitely make sure you listen, keep listening to the pod.
Well, I definitely will. And I've got read, as I'm sure you have, read Ron's book, Time's Up. It's a great read, you know, and I think it's going to be the way that legal services do get delivered in certain circumstances. And I think for new startup firms and smaller firms, it's definitely a model I'd be looking at.
Yeah. And I had Matthew Burgess on the podcast as well, who's, you know, part of VeriSage and into all that. And he and I both said, look, pure subscription can work in certain circumstances, but it's not going to work in every circumstance, which is why sometimes a combination of recurring and flat fee at larger amounts and recurring at smaller amounts is the way to go, which is really this nice hybrid of this pure subscription stuff that Ron does talk about in Time's Up, but also the traditional, but also anti-billable hour value-based pricing philosophy, right? So I think that there's a good hybrid in the future that we'll come to. But I also see, so this is, I'm trying to get people to subscribe to the Substack, because that's where I'm showing the videos of this podcast, and you can subscribe for free. So I see you've got a couple of books there. And so how about, with the time we have left, you show the camera those books and tell us a little bit about what's in them and why my listeners, who are mostly practicing attorneys, should check them out.
Okay, well, this is your first book. It's Harvard Business School, John Kotter, Our Iceberg is Melting. It's a book about change management. Lots of penguins on an iceberg. If we do not change our business, if they don't find a new home, they're going to die. Penguins and all the babies are going to drown. So that's the change management model, 8 steps. I took Kotter's 8 steps and made it into a methodology. This, and it's interesting about, you mentioned Matthew Burgess. Matthew, I interviewed for this book. So he's in there. Loads of Ron Baker in this book. But basically what I tried to do was create 8 steps to the implementation. And at the back of the book, it's got a 125-point task list where it says, "This is, if you want to do this, this is where you start." Item one on the task list is buy John Kotter's book. Yeah, and I should have put item two is make sure you read it, but I've assumed people will read it.
Right.
And then it's just a question of how you go about doing the implementation. And there's lots of materials, I've got links to Matthew Burgess's website. I've got links to Ron podcasts. I've got links to TED Talks. All of the stuff that will help the penny drop with lawyers in law firms. And we all learn differently. And what I wanted to do was create something that A, was fun to read, B, would provoke responses from people where they think, oh, okay, that's got me thinking. Set exercises for people to do, because I think lawyers want to change, they just don't know where to start. Now, this is kind of a roadmap. It's not a blueprint. You can't just say this 125-point task list will immediately work over my firm, regardless of size. It won't, but it will at least point you in the right direction and get you thinking about the problem.
Right. And another thing that you're doing that I want to make sure we let my audience know about is VBP Colony. VBP as in, if they haven't guessed it, value-based pricing. So tell us a little bit about the VBP Colony.
Right. Well, that you can access, your listeners can access that now from my website, bigyellowpenguin.co.uk. And it was an online community where I've broken the community down into the 8 steps of Ditch the Billable Hour. It has materials in there. I launched it 5 days ago. There's over 100 members in there now. Mm-hmm. And I want these people to have conversations. What are you doing? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? Can you help me with this? Because have I got all of the answers to all of the questions? No. But actually, with a group of 100 people, can we solve lots of these problems? I think so. Now, if that gets the colony gets bigger, even better. But I encourage people to come to the colony. I put up a TED talk earlier in the week. That got a conversation going straight away about people saying, oh, I love this guy's work, et cetera, et cetera. It is brilliant. We ought to use it. And that's great because you will come across something that I should read. I will come across something that someone else would read. Well, I'm not going to have the book printed at every 5 minutes, but I can put it in the colony so we can all access that knowledge.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, there's a few of these groups now in trying to disrupt the billable hour that are more and more cropping up. And especially the listeners to my audience, like, you know, these are our people, right? Like, this is our tribe. And so if social media is too much for you and LinkedIn groups and Facebook groups are too chaotic, I mean, like, these are the types of places that we can go to improve our practices. So it's great to see another one come up. I'm in there already, just started to click around because like Sean said, just opened up, but definitely link to that in the show notes. Check that out. Link to the book as well and to Sean's website. Other than that, Sean, is there... Actually, before I ask that question, I have to ask you the question I ask all my guests, which is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
I listened to one of your earlier podcasts and I thought I am going to be prepared for this. And I am going to tell you, an answer that you haven't heard and you can see why, because I put it in the colony and it was the TED talk I mentioned.
Okay.
And a hot dog is a metaphor for change, and a hot dog will help you give great hospitality. And you'll be thinking, Sean, what are you going on about? And if you look at the Will Guidara Secret Ingredients of Great Hospitality, this is a New York restaurateur who actually gave his clients, his customers, a hot dog. And it was the highlight of their gastronomic tour of America. So there you go. My answer is it is great hospitality. But if you're saying to me, what was the actual question? It was is it a sandwich or is it a?
Or is it not a sandwich?
It's a sandwich. But if you're keeping the stats on it, it's a sandwich.
Why? Why do you ultimately? First of all, that is a very unique answer. A hot dog is hospitality. I love that. But you say it's a sandwich, and I'm curious to know, why did you ultimately land on that?
Okay, because I think that I'll probably be stand corrected by all your listeners. The sandwich was invented by the Earl of Sandwich in the UK, and it had something between two bits of bread. So your hot dog cut down the middle is two bits of bread either side of the sausage. So I think it's a sandwich. But I think we might have to look into the origination of the word sandwich to make sure that we're actually bang on the money there.
You are not my first guest from the UK, and they also quoted the Earl of Sandwich. So, and I think I'm gonna have to go back and look because they might have even come down on the opposite side of the spectrum.
Oh, right. Said, well, we just need to get out more, clearly.
If it's not detached, right? I'm trying to remember what they said, but they might have said the same thing. We're a compilation episode coming in the near future. So I'm putting all these answers together and we're just going to do one episode. I think I almost have enough to make it a whole episode length. So I might have to do a few bits of compilation episodes. But thank you so much for that, Sean. Thanks for coming on the show. If anyone wants to follow up with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Best way, LinkedIn or via my website, bigyellowpenguin.co.uk or Sean, S-H-A-U-N, Jardine. I'm on LinkedIn. You'll see Declan, my inflatable penguin. We hang out a lot together, but anything penguin related, I tend to be there.
Well, great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Matthew. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.